The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine for the next hour. The edition we are now looking at is dated March 4th, 2019. To make sure we get this feature in, we go right to the back of the magazine to the interview feature. This edition, it's called 10 Questions. The subject of the interview is Ray Romano. Time says, the stand-up comedian and actor on money, family, success, and death, as well as some important subjects. Interview conducted by Belinda Luscombe. First question. After Everybody Loves Raymond ended in 2004, viewers didn't see you as often. But now with Get Shorty, your Netflix stand-up special, and new movie, Paddleton, our screens are wall-to-wall Romano. What happened? Answer. I've been working constantly since Raymond ended. It's just stuff that some people see, some people don't. I never stopped doing stand-up. And I've continued to do as much other stuff as I could, or as much as people wanted me. Question. You were reportedly making $1.7 million an episode by the end of Raymond. Does being rich make you more choosy? Answer. Yes. Yeah. I enjoyed watching Parenthood, and I called the showrunner, Jason Kadams, up. I left a message. Hey, I'm loving what you're doing, and I'm unemployed, and whatever my agent tells you it's going to cost, I will do much better than. And sure enough, they took me up on it. Question. Is there a threat to your dignity doing that? Answer. I wasn't a no-name begging for a part. Although I'm very insecure, so there's no way I thought I belonged on Parenthood. And when I was on it, I learned my lesson about looking on the Internet, because for all the people that loved me, there was just as many who said, what the F is he doing there? Question. Have you ever noticed that a lot of the roles you play are guys whose lives didn't quite work out as they'd hoped? Answer. I guess I'm attracted to that kind of story, the insecure guy, the underdog. I'm not going to be playing the super macho stud. I'm realistic. Yeah, now that you mention it, a lot of these characters are guys who haven't really gotten what they wanted and are still searching and reaching for something. Question. After such success, how can you still be that guy? Answer. Insecurity is relative. Before I thought my cab driver hated me, and now I think my limo driver hates me. Look, I think I'm good at stand-up. Am I a great actor? No. I'm learning. Every time I get a new role, I'm petrified and I break out in some kind of rash. Question. Paddleton is named after an invented ball game. What is it with guys and pointless physical feats? Answer. I don't know, but I'm very competitive. When I golf, I make little bets. If I don't break 90, I can't watch TV for 2 days. Question. At one point in the movie, your character waits too long to say, I love you. Why is that phrase so hard to say? Answer. I grew up never hearing it from my father, but it doesn't flow out of my mouth either. My brother and I played on the same softball team, and we had a hard time even high-fiving each other. I always say if my father hugged me once, I'd be an accountant right now. Question. In your special, you joke about your genitalia, your sex life, your wife and kids, all in front of them. How do they feel about that? Answer. To be honest, they're sometimes a little jealous when they're not in the bit. I'd never do anything they felt uncomfortable about. My wife gives me a long leash. I have to give her credit. She knows it's comedy, and she knows it pays. She's got a movie theater in her backyard. That doesn't pay for itself. Question. You've been married for 30 years. Is a long leash the secret? Answer. Listen, here's the thing. I'm in show business. You can't not be a bit of a narcissist and not need attention to be in that business. So the reason this works is because she is a person who, A, doesn't need attention, and B, can understand how I feel about her, even though it's hard for me to outwardly express that. She's the hero here. Final question. Your new movie is about death. How would you like to die? Final answer. Sniper. A very good sniper. I don't want her to have to come down and check me out. Interview by Belinda Luscombe for Time with Ray Romano, stand-up comedian and actor. We go now to the front of the magazine, and we go to the beginning feature called For the Record, the one-page collection of small news items, each one illustrated by a caption in bold, a line drawing in two colors, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page, a story illustrated by a quotation from Li Leung, former gymnast and the new president of USA Gymnastics. Quotation from Lili Leung, quote, "It really broke my heart to see where the sport was," unquote. Time's caption goes on to say, "She takes over the organization after its fumbling response to the sexual abuse conviction of former team doctor Larry Nassar." In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bold red, 1.58 degrees Fahrenheit. Caption explains, average amount by which global January temperatures were above average this year, which ties the third highest such value on record, 1.58 degrees Fahrenheit. In the lower right corner of the page is a version of the feature within a feature called Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Rick Perry, House Dems to probe Energy Secretary's role in nuclear sales pitches to Saudis. At Good Week, Katy Perry, the pop star, got engaged to actor Orlando Bloom. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 2.5. Caption explains, estimated wingspan in inches of Wallace's giant bee, the world's largest bee. Scientists in Indonesia recently rediscovered the species, which hadn't been seen since 1981. 2.5 inches wingspan. That item is also accompanied by a black and white line drawing of the bee. In the lower left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. president, reacting on Twitter to Saturday Night Live, which he said, quote, should be looked into, unquote. And the main quote from Donald Trump, U.S. president, quote, question is, how do the networks get away with these total Republican hit jobs without retribution? Unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Luciana Berger, one of seven members of the U.K. Parliament, who left the Labour Party on February 18th over party leader Jeremy Corbyn's handling of Brexit negotiations and prejudice within the party. And the quotation from Luciana Berger in bright red, quote, I cannot remain in a party that I have come to the sickening conclusion is institutionally anti-Semitic, unquote. In the upper middle of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York City, after Amazon canceled plans to build a second headquarters there. And the quotation from Mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, in black and all caps, quote, corporations can't ignore rising anger over economic inequality, unquote. Caption goes on to say, in a New York Times op-ed, de Blasio accused Amazon of not trying hard enough to work with local activists who voiced concerns about the city's deal with the company. Lastly, in the lower center of the page, is a story illustrated by a quotation from James Grine, identified as a victim of abuse by ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, after the Vatican defrocked the powerful cleric for, quote, solicitation in the sacrament of confession and sins against the sixth commandment with minors and with adults, unquote. And the quotation from James Grine, quote, today I am happy that the Pope believed me, unquote. On the next page, we go right to the opening of the major front section called The Brief. And the first story, always called Opener. And here the headline is, the U.S.-Europe rift brings nuclear risks. This subsection is World. Article here by Simon Schuster, Dateline, Munich. It's been the stuff of nightmares ever since the Cold War. U.S. officers detect a Russian missile taking flight, and they have just a few minutes to counsel the president on how to react. Under the treaties that govern nuclear arms, those officers have the information they need to help make the right call and to avoid such scenarios from arising in the first place. But these safeguards are now in jeopardy. Two of the treaties that buttress the world's post-Cold War security architecture, setting strict limits and enforcing transparency on both the U.S. and Russian arsenals, are in the process of unraveling. The Trump administration said February 1st that it would withdraw the U.S. from the international The Trump administration said February 1 that it would withdraw the U.S. from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, parenthetically INF, on the grounds that Russia had been violating it for years. In 2021, a separate treaty that governs long-range nuclear missiles, known as the New START, is due to expire. Renewing it would likely take years of talks. But so far, quote, we have not been offered any meaningful consultations, unquote, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told an annual security summit on February 16th in Munich. If talks don't begin soon, most experts believe the treaty will lapse with nothing to replace it. The unwinding of these agreements comes amid a global buildup of arms. The U.S. and Russia are racing to develop more compact and precision-guided nuclear missiles. China shows little interest in negotiating curbs on its own fast-advancing arsenal. And the Middle East is edging toward an arms race of its own, especially after the Trump administration pulled out of a deal to stop Iran's nuclear weapons program last year. According to the analytics firm Jane's, by IHS Markit, arms spending in the Gulf has risen by 25% since 2013 to an estimated $103 billion this year. But the shifting balance between nuclear states should be of most concern, says François Heisberg, a military expert who served as an advisor to the French Defense Ministry during the Cold War. Without the rules of transparency written into the nuclear treaties between the U.S. and Russia, he says, both sides would become blind to each other's nuclear arsenals. For military strategists, that has one disturbing consequence. Heisberg says, quote, treat every crisis as having full-blown nuclear potential, unquote. The world already has no shortage of crises with room for nuclear miscalculation, especially involving Russia. In the Middle East, Africa, Eastern Europe, and even the Arctic, Russian forces are operating in close proximity to those of the U.S. and its allies. They sometimes clash, as when Turkey shot down a Russian fighter jet in 2015, or when Russian mercenaries attacked U.S. Marines last year near a gas plant in Syria. What makes such skirmishes even more dangerous is the growing strength and reach of Russia's military. In her forthcoming book on the subject, Bettina Rentz, an associate professor at the University of Nottingham, concludes that Russia's, quote, stocks of weaponry have been comprehensively replenished, unquote, over the past decade or so. And on February 20th, in a major public address, Vladimir Putin made it clear the growth is unlikely to stop. The U.S. has the right to pull out of treaties, he warned, but, quote, let them count the speed and the range of the weapon systems we are developing, unquote. During the Cold War, such threats from the East typically would have pushed the West to develop a joint response. That no longer seems to be the case. The loss of trust between the U.S. and Europe was especially palpable at this year's Munich summit, a traditional show of mutual reassurance among NATO allies. In her speech to the summit, German Chancellor Angela Merkel complained that the U.S. decision to scrap the INF Treaty was made without consulting Europe, even though the treaty concerns Europe's security most of all. Quote, we sit there in the middle with the results, unquote, Merkel said. Minutes later, when Vice President Mike Pence delivered a greeting from his boss, President Donald Trump, the room full of European diplomats responded with stony silence. Their chief concern at the summit, at least when it comes to nuclear security, was the U.S. move in May to pull out of the deal with Iran. That deal took nearly a decade to negotiate, and it committed the Islamic Republic in 2015 to halt its nuclear weapons program. Yet, despite U.S. intelligence agencies reporting the deal was working, the Trump administration scrapped it, imposing new sanctions against Iran and pressuring European allies to do the same. Germany, France, and the UK have so far refused. Quote, we are not on the same page with our allies on any of this, unquote, says Ernest Moniz, the former U.S. Energy Secretary, who was one of the lead U.S. negotiators of the Iran deal. Along with 43 other diplomats and experts from the U.S., Russia, and Europe, Moniz issued a statement on February 14th calling for dialogue between the world's nuclear powers. Among its appeals was for nations to, quote, begin the process of rebuilding trust, unquote. That process was hard enough during the nuclear standoff of the Cold War. It's even harder now that China, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and others are arming up. But without the trust to begin negotiations, the world's systems of nuclear checks and balances will continue unraveling one treaty at a time. That was the entire article by Simon Schuster. On the facing page, in a subsection called The Bulletin, the headline is, Europe grapples with taking back citizens who joined ISIS. Article by Joseph Hinks. He writes, European officials had a mixed reaction to President Donald Trump's tweet on February 16th, asking Britain, France, and Germany and others to take back, quote, over 800 ISIS fighters, unquote, whom U.S.-backed forces captured in Syria. The alternative, he warned, is that, quote, we will be forced to release them, unquote. The demand added to an already tense debate about how to deal with European citizens who fought for ISIS, as well as their wives and children. And here, author Joseph Hinks names three items. First item, caliphate collapse. The U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, parenthetically SDF, says ISIS-controlled territory, which once spanned an area the size of Britain, has shrunk to a single enclave in a village near the Iraqi border. And, despite analysts' warnings that the group still poses a threat, I'll repeat that for clarity. And despite analysts' warnings that the group still poses a threat, the U.S. is planning to pull its troops from Syria. Roughly a third of the estimated 6,000 Western European nationals who joined the militant group in Syria and Iraq have already returned home, but the SDF says it has detained at least 800 foreign fighters of nearly 50 nationalities and does not have the capacity to put them on trial. Second item, enemies of the state. Most EU countries have not committed to repatriating ISIS returnees. On February 19th, Britain moved to revoke the citizenship of Shamima Begum, who traveled to Syria to marry an ISIS fighter at age 15 and has begged to return with her newborn son. France has said it would take back militants on a, quote, case-by-case, unquote, basis. Germany has pledged to put foreign fighters on trial while saying repatriation would be, quote, extremely difficult, unquote. Final item, national responsibility. This situation raises questions over the legality of leaving citizens stateless, the ethics of abandoning children born in the caliphate, and the cost of repatriating returnees. In the UK, a former army chief has said treating fighters fairly would help prevent others being radicalized, but a petition calling for a ban on ISIS members returning garnered 500,000 signatures by February 20th. Back in Syria, the SDF warns that the camps of ISIS detainees represents a, quote, time bomb, unquote. Defusing it will require cooperation from leaders around the world. Entire article by Joseph Hinks, accompanied by an apology from your reading for mangling that one sentence. Sharing this page in the right margin is the feature news ticker. It consists of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, North Carolina fines ballot scheme. Investigators found November's 9th congressional district election in North Carolina involved a, quote, coordinated, unlawful, and substantially resourced absentee ballot scheme, unquote, to help Republican candidate Mark Harris. The state election board must decide whether to certify the results or call a new election. Middle item. Accusations after Kashmir attack. Following a suicide bombing that killed at least 40 Indian paramilitaries in Kashmir on February 14th, India accused Pakistan of having a, quote, direct hand, unquote, in the attack, and of sheltering the militants responsible. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan denied the charge and warned that Pakistan, quote, will retaliate, unquote, against any Indian military action. Final item. Shooting suspect had illegal gun. Five people were killed in a workplace shooting in Aurora, Illinois, on February 15th. The shooter, who was killed by police, had a previous felony conviction for beating a girlfriend with a baseball bat, a record that should have prevented him from legally owning a gun in the state. Moving ahead, and that brings us to milestones. The lead item, under died, Karl Lagerfeld, fashion firebrand. Observance written by Stephanie Zakarik. Humans who make beautiful things are not always beautiful people, at least not in the way we'd like them to be. But if Karl Lagerfeld, who died on February 19th at 85, wasn't always kind, he was well known for his wicked, sometimes cruel, quips. He was so exquisitely distinctive as a personality and as a designer that ignoring him was impossible. Born to an affluent German family, Lagerfeld grew up on a lavish estate near the Danish border, though his childhood wasn't necessarily easy. He spoke often with a kind of tempered affection of his tyrannical mother. The young Lagerfeld began his career as an assistant to couturier Pierre Balmain in 1955, eventually moving on to design for Jean Patou, Chloé, and Fendi, where he served as creative director until his death. But the designer's longest and most famous association is with the House of Chanel, which he joined in 1983. Coco Chanel had revolutionized fashion by introducing easy-fitting but impeccably constructed garments that freed women from construction. But by the 1970s, even her tastefully classic shapes had become stale. Lagerfeld swooped in like wind through an open window. His clothes were fresh and invigorating, season after season, even as they maintained proper respect for his forebear. He'd pair her trademark supple tweeds with biker jackets, or fashion her stayed boucle, into swingy ponchos, fusing tradition with glamorous modernity. That phrase again, fashion her stayed boucle into swingy ponchos. Lagerfeld's signature look, stiff Victorian shirt collar, dark glasses, steel silver ponytail, was itself an extreme, dazzling work of invention. But where's the line between self-caricature and irreproducible originality? Lagerfeld walked it like a dancer, His steps can never be duplicated. And out of respect for the subject and the writer, your reader will repeat that phrase also, accurately this time. But where's the line between self-caricature and irreproducible originality? Lagerfeld walked it like a dancer. His steps can never be duplicated. That was The Entire Observance, written by Stephanie Zakaric. Karl Lagerfeld. That item is accompanied by a full-color photograph. It's a group shot. Caption says, Lagerfeld in Paris in 2009 with models wearing his work for Chanel. And not only is Lagerfeld in the photograph wearing black and white, white shirt, black tie, black suit, black glasses, white hair, but the models are all, there are four of them, wearing black and white dresses. And the floor is black, and the furniture is white. The walls are white with black wall hangings. In the right margin of the page, under Dyed, John Dingell Jr., Congressional Constant, by Jennifer Granholm. Ty says, Granholm was governor of Michigan from 2003 to 2011. She is currently a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, Goldman School of Public Policy. Jennifer Granholm writes, John Dingell of Michigan was the longest-serving member of Congress ever, but he never cared too much about breaking records. Instead, he cared about what he did with that record-breaking time, and what a doer he was. The heart of this fearless lion of Congress stopped beating at 92 years on February 7th. During his 59 years in the House, it beat through what he called his proudest vote for the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It beat through his many votes to protect our air, our water, and our land. It beat through his gaveling Medicare into passage. His cause was working people. His downriver district was braided with auto workers, Catholics, and conservationists, lovers of Polish Pocksky, the University of Michigan, and the Democratic Party. He traversed its streets and met its residents even as a boy campaigning for his father, who served before him. John loved the outdoors, hunting, his country, his fellow veterans, and especially after his 2015 retirement, even Twitter. But above all, his heart beat for his wife, quote, the lovely Deborah, unquote. Just as John succeeded his father, she has succeeded him to continue his fight as the greatest tribute she could offer. He would admonish us not to mourn for him. He would exhort us instead to do. Jennifer Granholm, writing about John Dingell Jr. Under Dyed, Lee Radziwill, Tastemaker. Observance written by Wilder Davies. When John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, Lee Radziwill rushed to help her older sister Jackie as the First Lady dealt with her husband's death. The role was familiar. Radziwill, who died at 85 on February 15th, spent much of her life in the shadow of her sister. But that wasn't her whole story. Known for her role in shaping Jackie's signature style, Radziwill established herself as a fashion icon in her own right. She pursued creative ventures ranging from acting to interior design, and for 15 years, she was also a princess. before her divorce from her second husband, Prince Stanislaw Albrecht Radziwill, in 1974. The sisters' relationship grew strained after Jackie married Aristotle Onassis, whom Radziwill had been involved with earlier. But Radziwill remained a society mainstay, rubbing shoulders with the likes of Andy Warhol and Truman Capote. By the end of her life, Radziwill had cemented a reputation as a trendsetter, a regular attendee at New York Fashion Week and other events. Speaking to T Magazine in 2013, she said, quote, "If I wasn't curious, I wouldn't want to live," unquote. Observance by Wilder Davies on Lee Radziwill. That item is accompanied by a half-length black-and-white photo of Lee Radziwill. No caption. That is the entire content of the Milestones page. And we move on now. This item is called The Road to 2020. It's the cover story. And the subsection headline says, "A Guide to Winning the Wildest Democratic Primary in a Generation," by Molly Ball. Almost a year before the first votes of the 2020 presidential contest, Democratic candidates are all over the map. There is Elizabeth Warren in a drafty warehouse in Des Moines, Iowa, boasting to more than 1,000 people about forcing out a bank CEO. In South Carolina, Cory Booker's in a college auditorium, bringing the crowd to tears with his tale of the murder of a young boy from the Newark, New Jersey projects. Sherrod Brown's in an Ohio union hall, wondering in his raspy baritone if his party has lost touch with Middle America. The 2020 Democratic primary will be unprecedented. The field is likely to be the largest in history. There's no front runner in sight, and the stakes could hardly be higher. It's not just that many Democrats argue Donald Trump is a threat to American democracy. The party's very identity is up for grabs, as a vast and historically diverse crop of candidates brings big new ideas to a demanding, divided base. Quote, "The Democratic Party is going through a very large transformation," unquote, says party operative Simon Rosenberg, who's backed the winning candidate in every primary since 1988, but has no favorite this time. Quote, "The era of Clinton and Obama is ending and ceding to a new set of dynamics. The new Democratic Party is being forged in front of our eyes," unquote. The candidate voters choose to take on Trump may set the nation's ideological direction for years to come. Yet, for the first time since 1988, there's no clear favorite. Former Vice President Joe Biden holds a wide lead in early polling, and his would-be rivals anticipate he has secured $25 million in early donor commitments if he takes the plunge. Those close to Biden expect him to join the race, but while party insiders think he has a good shot, he's hardly a shoo-in. Biden's opponents privately believe much of his support will melt away once other candidates become better known. They also plan to remind voters how Biden, 76, grilled Anita Hill, cozied up to Wall Street, and pursued tough-on-crime policies in the 1990s. But Biden's biggest liability might be the idea that he represents the party's past, not its future. The notion of nominating an old white male in the age of Trump leaves many Democrats cold. The cultural energy on the left is about resisting white nationalism and toxic masculinity in the name of racial justice and gender equality. It's about formerly marginalized groups demanding to see themselves in their leaders, and millennials tired of baby boomer rule. Biden would be a throwback to an era of incrementalism and hierarchy that the new generation of Democrats is aching to leave behind. The 2018 midterms revealed three major forces creating today's party. The biggest was the power of women, who emerged in unprecedented numbers as candidates, organizers, and voters. Second was the rise of a vocal, ambitious group of young progressives, exemplified by the media-savvy 29-year-old Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But third, and larger in numbers than the AOC faction, was the crop of political newcomers who cast themselves as pragmatists, many of them military or national security veterans. These forces are pulling the party in different directions, and the struggle between them will shape the 2020 battlefield. Unlike in elections past, the party establishment isn't steering the race with money, endorsements, or political machinery. Democrats' elder statesmen are distant from the rising energies. President Obama is still beloved and has offered advice to several contenders, but sources say he's unlikely to take sides publicly or privately. Both Clintons feel like yesterday's news, each saddled with distinct political problems. The Democratic congressional leaders, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, are products of a different era. In these days of social media outrage and political cyber warfare, everyone has a voice. But no one knows whom to trust, much less follow. Fittingly, it's women, minorities, and younger candidates who have jumped into the race early, while many white male hopefuls remain on the sidelines, gauging the terrain. By the time Senator Bernie Sanders entered the fray on February 19th, there were already five women, two African Americans, a Latino, and a gay millennial among the 10 major declared candidates. Some moderate, white, male candidates suspect there's room for only one of them in the race. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe are unlikely to run if Biden gets in, according to sources close to both men. Quote, "At the end of the day, it will be about who can bridge the coalitions in the Democratic Party," unquote, says Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, who was mulling a run himself, but is aware that being a straight white male could be a liability for the first time in history. Quote, "Those are things I cannot change," unquote, he chuckles. As much as they would like to move away from white male dominance, some rank-and-file Democrats worry that doing so would hurt the party's chances against Trump. They fear that a woman or non-white candidate would be damaged by Trump's sexism and race baiting. And to the party faithful, winning is everything. Quote, "That's the first, second, and third quality people are trying to assess each of these candidates by," unquote, says Jeff Link, an Iowa-based Democratic strategist who's watching the hopefuls parade through his state and has not yet chosen a candidate. Quote, people are anxious to kick the tires, yet the candidates and see who is really the person who can best take on Trump next year. And that was vet the candidates and see who's really the person who can best take on Trump next year, unquote. A few key factors will define who ultimately becomes the front runner. First among them is the divided, demanding Democratic base, with factions ranging from centrists to socialists. Then there's the process itself, a tangle of new rules and changing calendars. There's the money chase, scrambled by surges in internet-fueled small donor cash, and candidates turn against corporations, lobbyists, and interest groups. Finally, there's the challenge posed by a singular opponent. The stories investigate each of those forces, offering a trail map of sorts for a campaign that is sure to get rough. Quote, everyone's behaving nicely now, unquote, Rosenberg says, quote, but by the fall, this will be a tough, hard-hitting primary, unquote. The debate clashes, micro-gaffes, scandals, and policy disputes are yet to come, and the sprawling field only increases the chances of an unpredictable result. The bigger and messier the contest gets, the likelier it may be that the Democrats get the one thing none of them wants, a second Trump term. Time notes, that article was by Molly Ball, with reporting by Philip Elliott, Dateline, Washington. In the following article, the headline is, a divided Democratic base is luring candidates to the left. Article also by Molly Ball. She writes, winning a presidential primary isn't magic. You figure out what voters want and then give it to them. But that's no simple task for the Democrats seeking the White House in 2020. This isn't the same party Bill Clinton or Barack Obama led. It's not even the same one that nominated Hillary Clinton less than 3 years ago. The party's base is more diverse and more female than ever before, with newly assertive feminist and racial justice voices demanding representation and respect. New policy ideas are flying. One cycle after Clinton's liberal incrementalism barely beat out Bernie Sanders' socialist vision, the party's politicians and policy wonks are debating a range of ambitious ideas. A resurgent democratic socialist movement has a high-profile presence not just on Twitter and among activists, but also in elected office, and it's advancing once marginal ideas toward the mainstream. Big tax hikes on the rich, an end to private health insurance, guaranteed jobs for all, and a climate-focused revamp of the economy. Quote, progressive ideas are now more mainstream, unquote, says Karine Jean-Pierre, a former Obama campaign and administration official who serves as chief public affairs officer for the progressive group Move On. Quote, many are popular with Democrats and even Republicans and independents. It says a lot about how far we've come as a country and a party, unquote. The party's center of gravity may have moved left, but the ideological drift shouldn't be overstated. Quote, there are a lot of myths about the Democratic primary electorate, including the narrative that it's super liberal, unquote, says veteran pollster John Anzalone, who conducted 100 focus groups before the 2018 midterms. the share of Democrats who call themselves, quote, liberal, unquote, or progressive, that is, quote, progressive, unquote, tends to be about half, which is higher than it's been historically, but hardly dominant. I'll repeat that for clarity. The share of Democrats who call themselves liberal or progressive tends to be about half, which is higher than it's been historically, but hardly dominant. Parenthetically, by contrast, about three-quarters of Republicans call themselves, quote, conservative, unquote. The other half of Democrats consider themselves moderate or even conservative. Quote, we're not the Republicans with their litmus tests, unquote, Anzalone says. Quote, there might be some single-issue voters on the margins, but most primary voters are pro-choice, pro-gay marriage, pro-gun control, and pro-environment. Beyond that, people really aren't gung-ho, people aren't really hung up on whether you do Medicare for all or just protect and improve Obamacare, unquote. Another myth is that the party's increasing diversity is driving its leftward lurch. In fact, it's the opposite. Non-Hispanic white Democrats, parenthetically about 60% of the party, are far more likely to call themselves liberal than black and Hispanic party members. While young Democrats are overwhelmingly liberal, about 60% of the party's primary voters are still over 50. Some potential and declared 2020 candidates have responded to this mix by positioning themselves on the left end of the policy spectrum, like Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Kirsten Gillibrand. Other hopefuls are playing to the middle. Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Mike Bloomberg, John Delaney, parenthetically, when many Democrats race to embrace the Green New Deal, Delaney, a former congressman and banker, came out against the plan. Candidates like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Beto O'Rourke may try to straddle the divide, betting that the ideological tests imposed by online activists aren't as important to actual voters. That suspicion is supported by interviews with voters on the early campaign trail. At a recent Warren rally in Des Moines, Iowa, Jen Kowanaki, 45, said ideology was less important to her than character. Quote, I'm looking for someone that has strong values and stances they're going to stick to, unquote, she said, standing in a line that stretched around the block. At a Booker event in rural Denmark, South Carolina, Yukina Williams said she was looking for an antidote to President Trump's divisiveness. Quote, I'm a liberal, unquote, she said, quote, but I'm looking for a candidate who can unify the country, unquote. Many primary voters express a similar yearning for bipartisanship, saying they want a positive and substantive message rather than someone who simply bashes Trump. The anti-Trump gadfly Michael Avenatti, who flirted with a presidential run, argues that the party needs a fighter to go toe-to-toe with Trump, and has taken to mocking candidates like Booker, who preach harmony. But to many primary voters, exhausted by Trump, a dose of hope and change is appealing. As always, style and charisma are likely to matter to voters at least as much as policy papers and voting records. Quote, these candidates are going to try very hard to distinguish themselves from each other, but their positions are pretty similar, unquote, says Democratic strategist Rodell Molyneux. Quote, it's going to be a lot more about the framing of your worldview than one specific vote, unquote. That was the entire article by Molly Ball. Here, the subsection is called, Can Any of These People Beat Donald Trump? Article also by Molly Ball. More than anything, more than policy or charisma or age or race or gender, Democratic voters say they care about whether a candidate can beat Donald Trump. The problem is, nobody knows how to beat Trump in an election because nobody's ever done it. Trump's 2016 opponents tried everything. His Republican primary rivals tried ignoring him. They tried reasoning with voters, pointing out that he wasn't a traditional conservative. Some tried ridiculing him. Marco Rubio insulted the size of his hands. Ted Cruz tried aligning himself with Trump, which was good enough for a second place. In the general election, Hillary Clinton pounded Trump's character and warned that he posed a danger to U.S. security. Like Cruz, Clinton built a data-driven, voter-targeted operation with expensive staff, offices, and technology. But these state-of-the-art campaign organizations were no match either. And we have run out of time for this episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time, please join us as we read to you from Time.